Good morning.
Sir.
As you know, I represent the defendant appellate in this case, Ronald Wayne Bryant. Mr. Bryant was charged with filing fraudulent tax returns for a number of individuals in the Richmond County area of North Carolina. Basically, he would recruit these folks and tell them that he knew a person who had worked as an IRS agent and that he thought that he could get these people additional returns from previous taxes they had filed, tax returns, and he actually assisted them in helping file other returns. In all, he was charged with filing 13 fraudulent tax returns. There were a total of 27 that he had filed over the time period, but was only charged with the 13. He entered a plea agreement where he pled guilty to two of the counts, counts 5 and 7. The government agreed to dismiss the remaining counts at the time of sentencing, which they did. The reason we're here today, and a key portion of the plea agreement, appears on page 19 of the joint appendix, and this was language included about restitution that he would be responsible for. 5C reads, subject to the defendant's ability to pay as determined by the court at sentencing, the defendant agrees to pay restitution for the total loss suffered by all victims, and I think victims is a critical term for us, which resulted from and is related to the offenses charged in the indictment herein. At the time of the plea, Mr. Bryant had some question about what that term meant. He asked for clarification at one point from Judge Osteen. That appears on page 28. Judge Osteen went on to explain to him, appearing on page 29, that he would not be could not be held responsible for restitution for any counts that he was not convicted of, but explained to him that under the terms of the plea agreement, and this is what Judge Osteen said to him at that time, however, in your case, in exchange for the dismissal or in exchange for the agreements contained in this plea agreement, you're agreeing that the court can order restitution for all of the offense conduct under the indictment without regard to whether it would fall under a dismissed count or a count to which you pled guilty. He asked if Mr. Bryant understood that, and he indicated that he did. At the time of sentencing, one of the issues that came up was whether Mr. Bryant had been involved in a position of abuse of trust. And the question was who the victim was in the case. As I said, I think that term victims in the plea agreement was important because it was the government's position at the time of sentencing that the victims were the people for whom he had filed the false tax returns, and that they would suffer because they would owe penalties, late fees, interest, and so forth because of these returns that had been filed for them. We had a fairly lengthy argument about that, and ultimately Judge Osteen agreed that the true victim in the case was the government and not the folks who had had the false returns filed for them. In determining the amount of restitution that was involved in the case, Judge Osteen required as a condition of Mr. Bryant's supervised release that he pay full restitution, not just for the counts that were dismissed and the counts he pled guilty to, but for all 27 tax returns that he filed. And it's our position that under the term of the plea agreement, Mr. Bryant's agreement was that his responsibility would be for counts related to the dismissed charges. And if the government had been right that the victims were the people that he filed the tax returns for, any additional or collateral damage they would have suffered, whether it had been the penalties or late fees or if they had had to engage attorneys or so forth. But that's not the case. The government was the victim here. Part of what I would ask the court to consider is that Mr. Bryant really would have had no incentive to enter this plea agreement if he had understood and known and had been clear to him that he would have had to pay restitution for counts that he hadn't been charged with.
So do you want to withdraw your guilty plea? Does your client wish to withdraw his guilty plea and
Honor,
back to square one?
Your Honor, that may be the appropriate result here.
Really?
Yes, sir. And the reason I say that is the guidelines still took into account all the charges that were dismissed. It really had no impact on his sentencing. Those things were included in what factored into his guideline range. So even though they were dismissed, he was still agreeing to pay restitution for those amounts. But he basically doubled the amount of money that he would have owned.
But didn't he get three-level reduction for acceptance of responsibility?
Yes, sir, and he would have received that.
He would give that up in order to avoid a speculative possibility that he may have to pay some of this money at some point in the future?
Your Honor, I think he still would have received that if he had notified the government in a timely fashion that he intended to plead guilty and had come into court and pled guilty.
Your belief here, if I understand your position, that I just asked you, which I thought you said yes, which kind of surprised me, he would be willing to withdraw his guilty plea, wipe out the plea agreement altogether in light of what arguably is an ambiguity, and go back to square one and face trial on all of these counts.
Senator, it doesn't necessarily mean that he would ask to go to trial. He could.
Well, that's what I was asking.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question.
Well, of course, you could always undertake a new negotiation, but I don't see any reason in this record why the government, if it were actually to have to go back to square one, I mean, I can't imagine any assistant U.S. attorney would give him the time of day.
Your Honor, he could still come to court and plead guilty. He was guilty on all counts. He would have been convicted at trial, and that's the reason why I accepted the plea agreement. Any benefit he received.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding you. So, in other words, what you're contemplating in response to my question, I guess, is if perhaps the court were to say there's an ambiguity here, there wasn't a meeting of the minds on the amount of restitution, and as a remedy, we vacate the conviction, everybody goes back to square one. So you're now saying, if I understand you, he would undertake either to negotiate a new plea agreement, or he would just come in and plead, as they say, straight up to the indictment.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Because your position is he would be better off under those circumstances.
Yes, sir, I believe he
would. Then, okay.
He wouldn't have that additional amount of restitution, really.
And you don't think that the additional restitution is encompassed by relevant conduct?
No, sir. Well, I think it is encompassed by relevant conduct. And
well, then how could he get around it if he goes back, pleads straight up, and the judge, without a plea agreement, simply says what the judge could have said here, it's relevant conduct.
Well, it is relevant conduct. We didn't dispute that at trial. It is relevant conduct.
Well, there was no trial.
Sentencing. Yes, sir. Yeah. It is relevant conduct for purposes of determining his guideline range, but he could not be required to pay restitution for the counts he had not been charged with. If he came
Do you
in,
have a case for that?
Well, Your Honor, yes, sir. The Huey case from the United States, the Supreme Court says you can't be required to pay restitution for counts you did not plead guilty to and under the statute unless you agree to it.
I see.
If you agree that you will pay restitution for dismissed counts, then you're responsible, and that is what Mr. Bryant thought he was doing here.
I see. So the government would have to supersede the indictment.
Yes, sir. Yes.
The government, so, okay.
If the government could, I'm not sure why charges weren't filed on the other 14 counts. It could be that statute of limitations had run. But the only benefit he would have received by taking this plea agreement, if he knew that he would have to pay an additional $56,000, would be that he would have 11 counts dismissed. He's still going to be a convicted felon, still going to be on supervised release. And really, there's no difference to him whether he's been a convicted felon for 2 counts or 13 counts, if the net effect is he has to pay almost double the amount of restitution involved. And that is his concern, and that was his concern.
Does he really think he's ever going to pay this?
Your Honor, I cannot speak for Mr. Bryant, but I think it is probably highly unlikely that he would have the ability to pay this.
He has joint and several liability to the government with his co-schemers, right,
if I
can call them that.
The co-schemer was not charged in the case.
No, I mean the co-schemer taxpayers.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
They're the primary obligors, right?
Yes.
And it's reasonable to think that government's going to go after them pretty vigorously.
Well, the government could. I don't know that the government has.
Well, the government has to, doesn't it? They're the taxpayer.
Well, I would assume so. I would assume the IRS would go after them, but I don't know that.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I'm trying to remember. Was it... When did you find out you were going to be required to pay all victims?
That was at the time of this. Well, by all victims, if you mean for...
Well, I mean more people than you.
Yes, sir, at the time of sentencing.
Okay, so was that before the sentence was given or after?
Let me back up. We realized that was going to be an issue when we received the pre-sentence report. And I filed an objection to that in a position paper, and that was part of what we were arguing at the time of sentencing.
Now, your guy, as I understand it, doesn't want to withdraw his plea if we agree that his plea agreement limited the amount of restitution.
And we think the correct reading of the plea agreement is that he wouldn't be responsible for that restitution. It would only be for the dismissed counts and maybe any collateral costs to the counts he was convicted of and the counts that were dismissed. If this court rules against him, then perhaps he comes back on a 2255 and asks to withdraw his plea on the basis that it wasn't knowingly and voluntarily entered. But we believe that the language that was put in the plea by the government, if anything, is ambiguous, and that because of that, the language should be construed in Mr. Bryant's favor and against the government.
Well, when the discussion was had about, after you found out through the PSR that the government was asking for total restitution, over $100,000 to be made, did he at any time move to withdraw his plea?
No, sir, we didn't at that point. We thought that the plea agreement was clear and that he would only be responsible for the restitution related to the counts of the indictment. And I think it's important to look at the wording and the language that Judge Osteen used when he explained that to him, that it would be both to dismiss counts and the counts he was convicted of. And at that point, he was confident that that was what he would be responsible and pay.
But later he found out
his understanding
was not the same as the judge's.
Yes, that's correct.
And that he did not move to withdraw his plea.
No, sir.
That time. You have any questions? I think we understand your position.
Yes.
I don't want to cut you off if there's more.
That's all I had at this point, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. You've got some time for reply, too.
Yes.
After you hear from
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Hobgood.
Thank you. Please, Court. My name is Harry Hobgood. I represent the government in this matter. First of all, to address something raised by Judge Davis, Your Honor, the IRS can't go after the taxpayers in this case, and in fact, in most of the cases like this, because there is only a 3-year assessment period for back taxes.
I see.
And under their regulations, they have to stop the civil side while a criminal matter is pending. It takes a long time to investigate one of these. Tax division has to review it, and it comes to us. And until he's finally sentenced, that 3 years usually has expired.
So it's not because they don't owe it. It's because limitations as far as the assessment.
And so we either get it from the preparer or we don't get it at all.
Can you withhold future refunds?
I don't think they can. They still have to assess before. They have 10 years to collect, but only 3 years to assess. And once that assessment period is gone, they're out of luck.
I see.
I think that this paragraph 5C is not ambiguous. If we look, first of all, the terms total loss and all victims are very inclusive. They're not limiting, but they're two operative phrases. The first is total losses resulting from the offenses in the indictment. That is restricted. I mean, if that were the only phrase, the defendant would win here. But there's another phrase related to the offenses charged in the indictment. Now, the defendant contends that he interpreted that as referring only to dismissed counts. That's not a reasonable interpretation because dismissed counts do not refer to the indictment. They're part of it. They're in the indictment. You would never describe a dismissed count as relating to anything in the indictment because it's already there. You would describe relevant conduct or uncharged tax returns in this case as related to the offenses in the indictment. And that's precisely what the court found at sentencing. Now, I would urge the court also to look at the Rule 11 hearing. There are four explanations of this paragraph given. The first is by Mr. Edwards himself. The court asked him to explain it. And he stated, this is on page 26, he agrees to pay restitution for the total loss suffered by all victims in the case. Now, Mr. Edwards did not say in the indictment. He said in the case.
But the case has to be an indictment, doesn't it?
It does. But there's also a special agent's report, an investigative file that goes with it. And
but not in every case. How in the world would counsel know what? If you define cases, what might be in the briefcase of the prosecution would be unlimited. What he's talking about is the people say on the street, catch a case, that means a charge. He says, so the charge is the indictment. Now, you're going to take case to mean whatever they may have been investigating. So that would be no end. You don't know what might be in that brief if you're going to define it as that. Wouldn't the normal parlance or understanding be when you say in this case means what was charged? And that would be both convicted and dismissed, but not anything you may be investigating. You think that's-
but I think, Your Honor, we deal with relevant conduct for sentencing purposes in all these white-collar criminal cases, in every single one of them. And I respectfully disagree that when we talk about the case, we're talking about the potential exposure through relevant conduct, all of the losses that could come in at sentencing. And that's the normal interpretation you would have rather than limit it just to what's in the indictment, because every defense attorney knows that's not what your client's going to be sentenced on. There could be other losses that will come in as well under 1B1.3.
But they thought they had an agreement to limit that. And the limit would be, so basically this was no limit at all. The effect, basically, what he had was basically nothing.
Well, it would be for the 27 tax returns that were investigated and included in the file. We merely picked 13 of them to put in the indictment. It would not go beyond those 27 returns because no others were audited.
Well, why not? Suppose you had audited more, then under your interpretation, you could put them in, right?
You could.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It was illusory. He got nothing out of the agreement. I mean, sometimes, you know, the government has to deal with some good faith. I mean, to me, at some point, have some reason. A lay person there, they're charged. I would think most people understand that. Understanding would be that they're talking about what you charge, and that's why they made the clarification. No, it's not just what you're convicted of, but also the ones that are dismissed. But then the whole, okay, why didn't you charge those? All of them.
Well, because, we try to economize sometimes in the indictment in case there is a trial. We don't need to put on all
the. But your economy is at the stake of constitutional protection sometimes. Because your economy says, oh, well, we don't want to put this through the ringer of constitutional test of a trial, which we hold very dear in this country. Instead, let's just wait and have an agreement, and we'll throw it all in that way. Is there something fundamentally wrong with that? And then to come here in the Fourth Circuit and ask us to endorse this interpretation?
Well, Your Honor, under the sentencing concept of relevant conduct, we rarely do include every solitary bit of relevant conduct in the indictment. In these white-collar cases, we just don't, we put in specific counts, and there's still losses that are going to come in at sentencing. That's standard. It's nothing done in this case to deceive a defendant.
No, but I'm just saying, in terms of, you're talking about money. It seems to me, I don't understand why you're just making money. Just listen, based on this agreement, we will ask for no more than this dollar amount. To me, that's common sense, but. Maybe don't do that.
I would like to do that, but our judges really don't want us to be that specific.
Why not? Wouldn't it make sense? You know, that's the thing. You go through a Rule 11 colloquy for the purpose of making it known, and then you never make anything clear. Just say, listen, if you plead guilty, this, this, this. What's wrong with that? Why would someone object to that common sense approach to constitutional protections and process?
I agree that it would be certainly in terms of the loss for sentencing purposes, it would be very helpful to have that in the plea agreement, but our judges do not like us to put it in.
So instead we're left with this. People think they're pleading to something that all kind of interpret and then come in, it's this. But never mind, it's not your fault.
I think if any confusion came up, it came up in the court's last two explanations during the Rule 11 proceeding when it was trying to explain the Huey decision to the defendant, which speaks in terms of dismissed counts, that the defendant's not responsible for them, only for the counts of conviction. And I think the court started repeating the terms dismissed counts, and maybe that's where the defendant went astray. But when we got to sentencing, the court did not waver. It was absolutely firm that this was a broad term related to, referred to all relevant conduct. And these tax returns are all the same. They're indistinguishable. They're in the same time period of the same falsities, were written by Mr. Bryant when he's operating the same tax preparation service. But it's just not a reasonable interpretation of this related to language to say that it refers to dismissed counts. You would never describe a dismissed count as related to the indictment.
And counsel should have known that. Defense counsel should have known that.
It's just a natural interpretation.
Right, that's what you said, but for the record, counsel should have known that, correct?
I think you should have, yes. Okay. Yes, sir.
All right.
And also, the defendant, you know, in his brief to the court, has not argued that he was misled by the court during the Rule 11 hearing, or that the court misinterpreted paragraph 5C. He's merely claiming that on its face it is ambiguous. And we contend that it is not, and would ask if you reject the defendant's argument and uphold the sentence here. So no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hopgood.
All right, thank you.
Edwards?
The question is whether this is an unambiguous plea agreement, and I think, at least as far as that section goes, Mr. Hopgood just admitted that it was ambiguous because he said in trying to explain it to Mr. Bryant at the time of his plea that the court may have misstated what the plea agreement was. But if Mr. Bryant is asking for clarification, which is what he did, page 28, bottom of 28. After the judge had discussed that, Mr. Bryant said, some clarification, Your Honor. And then the judge explained what we understood the agreement to be, that it would be offense conduct under the indictment without regard to whether it would fall under a dismissed count or a count to which he pled guilty. Unless he agreed to pay restitution for dismissed counts, he would not be responsible for that. And that was Mr. Bryant's understanding of the plea agreement. He would get some benefit by having 11 counts dismissed, even though it still counted against him for purposes of the sentencing guidelines. But again, if he had understood that he is basically agreeing to pay double the amount of restitution, he would have absolutely no incentive to not just come into court and enter a straight-up plea of guilty to all the counts.
And what do you contend, I know it's in your brief, is the correct amount of restitution?
It's slightly over $54,000, I think $54,292, something like that.
Now, the guidelines for fines in this case went up to $40,000. And, of course, the judge explicitly took into account, in not ordering a fine, the amount of restitution and your client's other obligation.
Yes.
To what extent should this court consider that in evaluating the proper outcome here?
Your Honor, I will tell you that in most cases where I've represented individuals where I've been court appointed, and I was Mr. Bryant's counsel below, where there are obligations of child support, most judges do not impose fines unless it's mandatory because they would rather have the money to go to child support than to pay any kind of fine.
Of course, but I think you understand what I'm getting at are the equities of the situation here.
Yes, sir.
I'm not suggesting that Judge Osteen would have imposed a $40,000 fine, but in fact, he didn't impose a fine, and part of the reason was because of this large restitution order that he was entering.
Well, I think it goes to one of your earlier questions, do I realistically think Mr. Bryant can pay this back? He's going to have a very difficult time becoming employed when he gets out.
Right.
He is actually going to finish this sentence, I think, next month. He had some other serious charges pending in state court in North Carolina. He'll begin a sentence then.
Oh, really?
Yes. He's going to be unemployable for all intents and purposes other than doing manual labor type jobs or being a greeter at Walmart. That's going to be his career aspiration.
And the judge didn't waive the interest on this restitution?
No, sir, he didn't.
So that's accruing as well?
Yes, it is. It is. And I believe had Judge Osteen ruled with us and assumed it was $54,000 in restitution, he would still have waived any fine in the case.
I have a different question.
Yes, sir.
I'm wondering, just thinking, whether or not it's relevant, whether or not the plea agreement is ambiguous or unambiguous, where the defendant says, I don't understand it, and indicates indecision as to what it means, and then an explanation is given to him by the court.
Yes.
I'm wondering if that does, if now we don't just focus on the explanation and disregard the question of whether or not the language in the actual plea agreement is ambiguous or unambiguous.
Well, I think at that point when the judge had answered that question, I believe it reaffirmed what Mr. Bryant believed the agreement to be, that this would just require that he pay for the dismissed counts. And again, I think the language in the plea agreement of victims is important because I believe the government assumed that the victims would include the individuals who had the tax returns prepared for them and that they had suffered losses that this agreement would help ensure that they were reimbursed for. I think that was what the
That's how I interpreted the plea agreement. I don't know if I put this in there. That's what I advised Mr. Bryant. And if this court rules that it is unambiguous and is wrong, then it wasn't a knowing and intelligent plea, and the next step he will do is file an ineffectiveness claim against me, which I'll agree with. I didn't tell him that he would pay this. If I thought he would...
At that point in the transcript where there's the pause...
Yes.
And the judge said, consult with Mr. Edwards, that's when you told him you're not going to have to pay all this...
Well, we had discussed it before. I mean, the question of the other money had never really come up. In discussing with Mr. Bryant, I explained to him the law that he couldn't be required to pay restitution for any distance.
But as Judge Traxler said, at some point, whether the plea agreement is ambiguous or not, there's an explanation given by the court.
Yes, sir.
And then the court actually says... Now consult with your attorney.
Yes.
To make sure you understand what I just said.
And I think the explanation that the court gave us what we anticipated, that it would cover not just counts he was convicted of, but dismissed counts as well. And that's how I read that language on page 29 of the joint appendix.
By the way, why isn't the government a victim in light of its inability to collect?
Well, it is a victim. We agree it is a victim.
I thought you said Judge Osteen concluded at sentencing that the government was not a victim.
No, Judge Osteen concluded that the individuals who had the tax returns prepared for them were not the victims. The true victim in the case was the government.
Oh, okay.
And that came up under a question of enhancement, whether abuse of trust. In order to have abuse of a trust or position of trust,
okay,
you have to have a relationship.
So that cuts against your argument, because if the government's the victim here, the government's out $110,000.
Well, I agree. The government is out $110,000, but
okay.
I think that the government's intent was to make sure the government thought that these folks were going to be included in the pool of victims and that they would be entitled for compensation for their losses. That was my interpretation of the plea, and that's what I thought.
After the judge gave the explanation, you thought you had damage control, if you will.
I thought I'd clarified it to what my understanding of the plea agreement was.
Right.
I see my time is up. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Edwards, I note you're court appointed. We appreciate very much your representation.
Yes,
so,
thank you.
Mr. Bryant. All right, we'll come down and greet counsel and then go into the next case.